You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO at 100.5 FM.
Capitalism permeates all of modern society, so much so that it's difficult to imagine things any differently. But things are not going well these days. High unemployment, especially among young people. Demands by the IMF to cut social services, calling it austerity. And slow economic growth in most of the world. Few deny that it's a broken system and in desperate need of change. But to even imagine how things can change, we first need to understand how the system works. Jeff Mann teaches political economy and economic geography at Simon Fraser University. He's author of a new book just out from AK Press called Disassembly Required, a field guide to actual existing capitalism. And he joins me in the studio now. Hello, Jeff.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's our pleasure. Now, there's a lot of books out there about economics.
There is, yeah.
What did you want to bring differently with this book?
No, it's a great question, because if you walk through the bookstores these days, that what you will notice is there's a billion books explaining the crisis and all of the rest of the things and how things are working or not. And so it was definitely something I thought about when I was trying to put this book together. But I feel like, especially from a critical perspective, people who are concerned, even if they're not exactly aware of all the details, they're just sure that things are not quite right. I feel like there was no book that was neither an economics 101, so an attempt to do, you know, basically very orthodox mainstream economics for average people who are unfamiliar with some of the terminology. There are many, many of those books that tell you how capitalism is supposed to work according to the theories that got us into the trouble we're in. And then on the other side is a huge slew of books that are basically shrill denunciations of capitalism. It sucks, right? Everybody knows it sucks. And what I wanted to provide was a critical perspective, but one that was very straightforward in explaining how capitalism actually works in the world.
Okay. So that was what you set out to do. So what are some of the features of capitalism then that are not taught in business school?
Well, in some ways, one could say that the things that are not taught are the things where the rules are broken. Economics is premised on a whole set of behaviors or assumptions about human behavior that we all rationally optimize given budget constraints, that everyone follows the rules all the time. These kinds of things are fundamental to the theories that back up most of how we run the world. And in practice, as we know, the world is a very, very complicated place. And the first thing anything economic is, before it's even economic, is social. In other words, everyone who makes the economy up lives in a real world, has real fears and desires, communities, homes, cultures, backgrounds, and heritages. And all of those things throw big wrenches into everyday economic behavior.
So if we look at something, for example, like the free market that we're told about all the time, mm-hmm. is a free market really free?
No. Absolutely, it's not free at all. Before I follow up that question, the one thing I would want to do is definitely flag the fact that even the most mainstream orthodox conservative economist would not say the free market is actually free, some sort of libertarian dreamland. In no way is the free market free. And the first thing we know in any kind of examination of the market is the fact that the state plays a key role in enforcing the property rights that make markets possible. So there's no such thing as a free market even from step one. We can't even imagine it because it's a farcical notion. But even, you know, Hayek and the people that get named as sort of the fathers of neoliberalism, they knew that too. So this is not to in any ways a criticism of these folks, but it is a fact that nonetheless we must continually bring up, because the dream itself seems to organize the thought of the people in charge. You mentioned the IMF in the introduction. You know, this is an attempt to reach an ideal of frictionless economies that is literally in practice impossible. So trying to organize our social life around a norm that is itself unrealizable and does great injustice and hurts a lot of people materially seems to me to be a really poor choice of direction, especially at this moment.
How has capitalism managed to persist for so long? Why is it so robust?
Yeah, well, that's a great, great question. And this is one of the things that in the book I really try to emphasize. It's one of the ways I really try to avoid being a shrill denunciation of capitalism, because it in many ways its historical achievements are unprecedented, and it has undoubtedly provided us with wealth and security that would have seemed unimaginable 400 years ago. It's almost funny to think about. So we certainly can't discount what it's been able to achieve. I think a lot of its robustness revolves around, well, we could probably go on and on, but a couple of things. The first is that, for the most part, it has not been organized according to some grand plan. Now, there are conspiracy theorists out there, you know, who imagine puppet masters and all of the rest of it. I'm not one of those folks. I think, for the most part, capitalism operates, has ideologically captured most of the population so that we just play along and we reproduce it every day. We don't need a grand plan, and its evolution has been much more flexible. So this is one of the things that marks it out quite strongly against, say, something like a Stalinist five-year plan, where we have all the answers for all the questions that you can think of in the next 5 years. Capitalism has not tried that, and that's been one of its great merits. And then secondly, I think that it's the integration of the state with the economy that has made, the legitimacy of the way of living a really significant part of its persistence. Most of us think of it as how people naturally would be.
So the book is called Disassembly Required. So why is disassembly required?
Mm-hmm.
Why do we need to take apart capitalism?
Well, we do, absolutely. But I would, perhaps this is a kind of almost heavy-handed, but I did intend to somewhat double entendre in the title, because when I say disassembly required, I'm also trying to say we really need to understand it. Any kind of attempt to change or understand what is changeable or needs changing requires, in my opinion, a deep and considered analysis. Another attempt on my part, at least, hopefully successfully, to avoid being shrill. Now, we really need to understand what's going on here. And when we do, we'll discover that capitalism is actually, the most important reality on the planet today, I would argue. So this is a long fight. We cannot fool ourselves into thinking that some act of imagination is going to somehow get us to leap historically to some utopian future. But also, from a purely political perspective, I think that increasingly, if it wasn't obvious before, the inequalities that capitalism produces by its very nature, these are not accidental outcomes, but inequality and poverty are a product of capitalism, as I explain in the book. And there are intelligent capitalist theorists like Keynes who saw this himself. This is one of his great fears, is that capitalism would kill itself because it would produce a rabble at the bottom that was not allowed in. And that's precisely what it's doing. So that's one reason. And then the second, I think, is the sort of obvious point. In fact, it's so obvious I don't cover it a ton in the book, which is that it's running up against its ecological limits. And those happen to be ours as well. So in my opinion, capitalism is a done deal in the next century. The question is whether we do it and take it apart in a way that's good for people, or if the planet does it for us. I'd prefer not to wait for the second option.
So is there a point which you would mark as the beginning of the end for capitalism?
I don't know. I don't know. I don't have a good answer for that question. I think that there are ways in which we can see the signaling of what could be. And partly it's the chaos of that is a good indicator, I think, of potentially near-term futures. My fear, of course, is that we could be on a sort of trajectory that, even setting aside the ecological limits, could be, a sort of a saddle point where we head one way or the other. I think capitalism is in its, not say death throes, but it's on a trajectory toward it, its own end. Now, but that end could not be pretty. And I would say that's true no matter how hard we struggle, that we might lose this battle. It's something I think we have to think about very seriously. But on the same side, if we're heading to some set of positive futures that we might celebrate, surely those won't be take a single form or be of a single shape. I don't know what the future should look like, but I'm pretty sure it will look like a whole lot of different futures in a whole lot of different places for a whole lot of different people.
Some people point to the end of the gold standard in the 1970s. Do you think that was a critical point?
I do. I do, absolutely. And this is part of what I would call the mainstream account of the change, and I think it's bang on. The end of the gold standard, at least in the indirect form it had post-World War II, up until the early 1930s, as you may know, the gold standard was really truly the gold standard. Every country that was on the gold standard had gold reserves, and their currency was printed based on how much gold they had in the economy, and you couldn't inflate. You couldn't deflate your currency because you didn't have enough gold. After Keynes and some others arranged the Bretton Woods agreements following the Second World War, the only country that was actually on the gold standard was the United States, and everybody else's currency was pegged to the American dollar, if that makes any sense. So when the Americans basically ran out of money in the 1960s to pay for Vietnam, to deal with internal strife around civil rights and labor uprising, and they needed to print more money, but they were constrained from doing so by the amount of gold they had, they consistently tried to deflate the U.S. dollar, which at the same time deflated all of the other international currencies that were pegged to them. In so doing, exporting inflation, because everyone else's currencies are becoming less and less valuable as they do this themselves. By 1971, Nixon had rightly decided that this was no longer tenable, and he unilaterally ended the gold standard and finished the Bretton Woods, at least monetary arrangements. That moment of crisis in American hegemony, if you want to call it that, power in the global political economy, made way for significant and disorder that no one was prepared for, both at the monetary level, but also in the fiscal programs and things like that that money had been able to support. And in the United States' attempt to restructure their own economy in the interests of basically finance and big business, which had been on the losing end of the bargains, one might argue, since the Second World War, they reasserted the power of capital in their own economy in what it was then a very, very, and still is today, a very, very unstable international order. And in so doing, they destabilized everything. So for example, when they raised their interest rates in 1979 to historically unprecedented levels, 18% at the nominal level, not worrying about inflation. Because of the new system, that meant that was the inflation rate. I mean, that was the interest rate for the whole global economy. And so all of a sudden, if you're Mexico and you owe money to the United States at 5%, and then the United States changes their interest rates to make it 18, then when you want to restructure your loan or renegotiate your loan, you're not looking at 5% anymore. You're looking at 18, 20, 25, depending on who you are. And so the 80s were a lost decade for many developing countries. And all of this is a product of the collapse of the Bretton Woods.
Are the modern nation states and capitalism inextricably linked? So that if you think about the end of capitalism, are we also then thinking about the end of the modern nation
right.
state?
It's interesting. It's a great question. And again, unfortunately not one I have an answer for, or at least something that I would grace with that term, answer. But it is a situation in which the modern nation state and capital are so intertwined and dependent upon each other, clearly. I mean, here in Canada, we live, in my opinion, very obviously in a nation state that whose health and welfare is entirely dependent upon the health and welfare of its capitalist industry and its capitalist class, for the most part, that makes up its government. These seem to me to be undeniable facts. The hope or fear that we might be able to have something non-capitalist that we would celebrate. Clearly, we're not just in for any old non-capitalism. I'm not interested in the USSR in 1937. I'd rather capitalism, to be honest with you. But if we're going to talk about some sort of change, I think that it is quite likely that we're talking about the end of the nation state, but it's also possible that we're not. And I am not a person who would celebrate, at least in the short term, the disappearance of the state structures because of their political capacity right now, which I think is essential, that if eventually some non-capitalist, justice-oriented government were in power, the effect of those institutions would be crucial to their capacity to, you know, extend some sort of more just social system, not to mention something like environmental regulation, which right now the state is the only legitimate arm by which to exercise, things like that, and we desperately need it.
Thanks so much for coming in, Jeff.
Oh, well, thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
I've been speaking with Jeff Mann. He's director of the Center for Political Economy at Simon Fraser University. His new book is called Disassembly Required, a Field Guide to Actually Existing Capitalism, and that's available from AK Press.